Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Hospice New Zealand Genesis Oncology Trust Lecture 5. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. This morning there will be a presentation, followed by a question and answer session. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded, and at this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Our speaker today is Chris Hall. Chris Hall is a director of the Australian Centre for Grief and Bereavement, a position that he has held for the past 15 years. He is a psychologist and is also currently chair of the International Workgroup on Death, Dying and Bereavement. We are delighted he can join us today from Victoria, Australia, to share his expertise. Welcome, Chris. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Alvaro, and it's lovely to be with you this morning. I'll talk for about three-quarters of an hour, and then we'll have about 15 minutes of questions. Hopefully you can see in front of you a PowerPoint presentation, and I'll walk through each of those slides. We'll try to cover a fair amount of terrain in the next 45 minutes, and then hopefully during the quick Q&A we can explore perhaps some other areas that might be of interest. But let's move off the title slide to what will be slide two, titled Grief is Our Response to Loss. One of the issues, I guess, in terms of many current texts that define or describe grief is that it's described very much in terms of an emotional response to loss. And I think that's a very limiting perspective. If we look at a lot of the early research in the field of grief and bereavement, it was largely research done with white, middle-class, Christian, North American and British women who are about 60 or 70 years of age and whose partners have died in the previous 2 to 3 years. So in many ways, the very early models of grief were really models of widowhood. And I think in some ways, perhaps focused particularly on the emotional response. But it is clearly a multifaceted experience. It affects the way we feel, often producing feelings that may be foreign or unexpected. It affects our bodies. Grief has significant health impacts, and we'll look at those in a moment. It affects the way we think. We have many people presenting at our clinical service saying that they think they're going crazy. There's a range of thoughts that might be surprising or even for some people horrifying. It affects the way we behave, often pushes us to the extremes of our behavioural repertoire, where we may, for example, have no energy, a sense of bone-numbing tiredness and exhaustion, through to others who might kind of have a manic overactivity and keep themselves incredibly busy. Sleep would be another important aspect here. A high-value question is asking people how they've been sleeping. Insomnia is a very strong marker for complications in bereavement. And I think also historically, grief has been seen as an experience that happens in the head and heart of a single disconnected individual, when in fact, of course, grief always has a social context. That we need to understand the experience of grief within family relationships, that families have feeling or grieving rules that in a sense dictate to what extent this is an experience we talk about, to what extent is this an experience that we seek support from each other, or is it seen as a private experience? We could also see this applying in the workplace, the extent to which emotions are seen as private affairs and the extent to which a workplace provides space for recognition of the impact of grief. And I think this is particularly true in particularly a palliative care setting, the extent to which grief impacts upon us both professionally and personally. And I think more broadly at a cultural level, there are certainly feeling rules as well, or grieving rules. If you look at most workplace leave policies in terms of bereavement leave, certainly in Australia, we get 3 days leave for the death of a family member, which is, I think, a strong cultural communication that grief is like the flu. You know, we go through this intense period of distress and pain and very rapidly return to a previous level of function. We also know that social support starts to diminish 3 to 4 days after the death. So there's this expectation that by the time you've defrosted the last casserole, thrown out the last bunch of flowers, that life in some way returns to a kind of a normality, and social support often diminishes quite quickly. And I think the final dimension, and perhaps the one that's most overlooked, is that grief also has a significant spiritual or philosophical dimension, that these are experiences that raise big questions of meaning for people. You know, why did this happen? Why did this happen to him or her and to me? How do I reconcile this with my system of belief, whatever form that might be? And what we generally find is that those who are struggling the greatest following loss are those who are searching and have not yet found any meaning in this loss. They've found no way of integrating this experience into the way they see their world or the way they see themselves and their own identity. So let's move on to the next slide, which should be number three. And this is really just a very brief summary of the prevalence of some significant health problems for the bereaved. The general message here is that for a significant minority of bereaved people, there are some significant health difficulties. We know that grief depresses the immune system in general, but if we look at a sample of young widows, 20% are experiencing significant and severe physical health problems 4 to 6 months after death, and 12% continue after 2 years to have significant health difficulties compared to a married population where the rates are 3%. In terms of PTSD, following the death of a partner, half of that sample experienced or met criteria for PTSD on one or four occasions. And then on four occasions, 9% of that population. Some recent research we've been doing with the Centre for Palliative Care in Melbourne has surprised us in terms of the high rates of PTSD in carers. If we look at clinical depression, which is certainly related and shares some common variants with bereavement, but is actually clinically distinct, we see that 2 months after death, up to 30% of the population have meet criteria for clinical depression. And finally, complicated grief, which is variously termed complicated grief or prolonged grief disorder, in a group of widowers, the reports come in around 5 to 1/3 of that population meet the criteria. I think the figure that the field's settling on at the moment is about 10 to 15% of a bereaved population will go on to develop what's now being referred to as a prolonged grief disorder. And we'll talk more about that a little later. So we can move on to the next slide, which will be number four. Here I just really want to talk about, quite briefly, six major shifts in thinking that have really taken place in the last decade and a half. And the first would be that we've moved away from the kind of cookie-cutter approach to grief, that people move through a more or less orderly trajectory following loss, that the adaptation to loss is actually more complex, the trajectories are more varied in their form. And of course, this is perhaps best known by some of the task or stage models of grief that suggest that we move, in many ways, like the flu, from an acute period of distress and then move through a very rapid return to a level of recovery. The next slide looks at the second theme, which is that we've moved away from the idea that grieving involves a letting go of the emotional bond to the deceased. We've moved away from the broken bonds view of grief, that we need to let go and disconnect from the deceased, to one which recognises the healthy ongoing connection, the continued bond with the deceased. And this has certainly had a very significant impact on interventions, that now it's not so much a case of rituals of saying goodbye, but a recognition that death ends a life, but it doesn't end a relationship. The third theme would be that historically grief has been seen as an emotional experience, and there's now been a broadening to suggest that there are also important cognitive processes as well that really in many ways complement the traditional focus on the emotional consequences. So again, the sense of how people think about the loss, the meaning they make from and about the loss is of real significance. The next slide looks at theme four, which is the idea that grief is not just this external experience or event that we process, but it also can bring about a significant change and shift in our sense of who we are and a sense of identity. So for many people, the experience of bereavement can bring about a significant shift in how they see themselves. This might be in terms of how they define themselves. It might be in terms of a recognition of changes in their identity. In their identity. So this is the sense of relearning the self. The fifth theme is that grief has often been seen as this kind of toxic event that inevitably and necessarily leaves people injured in some way. There's a growing recognition of the role of post-traumatic growth, that there is this silver lining in this dark cloud of grief, that people can identify how they've been changed by this experience, but change in positive ways. Then this might be in terms of identifying aspects of resilience or a capacity to cope with other sorts of adversities in life. The next slide, slide 7, focuses on the last shift. And this is one I alluded to earlier, that we've moved away from this idea of grief being purely kind of an intrapsychic experience to a recognition that there's a reciprocal impact on families and the broader cultural groups, that people draw from cultural traditions and practices, as well as family practices as well. So the way that a family has construct conversations about the loss, and in many ways co-construct meaning following the loss. So the moving past the next title slide, which briefly we'll look at some historical and theoretical milestones, brings us to slide 9. And this is really a recognition of the seminal involvement and work of Sigmund Freud in his 1917 paper called Mourning and Melancholia. This was Freud's attempt in many ways to draw a distinction between grief and depression. Freud, in fact, never worked with a bereaved person, but he consulted with a colleague, Breuer, on a young woman whose father died and who developed a whole range of conversion reactions. But nonetheless, he in his paper, wrote the view that really grief is an intrapsychic rearrangement of emotional connection, that we need to withdraw the emotional energy that we've invested in relationships, and we need to withdraw that following death. So the first primary task in Freud's view was that we need to free the bereaved from bondage to the deceased. We need to break this bond between the living and the dead. In some ways, the dead had no place in the land of the living. The second theme was to readjust to a new life without the lost person. So very much a case of relearning the world. And the third component was about building new relationships and new connections and investing these new relationships in emotional energy. This really dominated the field up until the last probably two decades or so. The idea of freeing the bereaved from bondage to the deceased was the primary therapeutic task. Now, it's interesting that if we look more closely at Freud's writing, Freud was, in fact, a bereaved father. And he writes in his personal letters later in life that, in fact, we never give up on a relationship. We never renounce a relationship. We form a kind of substitute or surrogate. And so following the death of his daughter, his private writings actually convey something quite different, that in fact we don't break the bond, we continue the bond, but in a transformed and changed way. We move on to the next slide, titled Attachment Theory. This is really looking at the important work of John Bowlby, the British psychiatrist, who was heavily influenced by the work of Charles Darwin and suggested that we are hardwired to develop strong emotional connections to others, and that these emotional connections or attachments ensure the survival of the species. So from a very, very young age, we develop attachments, particularly with primary caregivers. These attachments vary in terms of the strength. We might visualize an attachment to steel cable between, say, a mother and a child, or it might be a more flexible and a much looser connection from somebody who's much less a part of our emotional world. But these attachments also provide a sense of security. We return to these attachment figures, for example, as a child when distressed. These attachments ensure a sense of safety. They're places we go to when we're under stress, and this might be a partner in adult life. But they also provide a secure base. And we see this often with young children entering a new environment where they may, you know, clutch the clothes of the parent, and from there explore that new terrain. And if there was a loud noise, they return to that parent. But generally, these experiences, particularly in early life, give rise to what we call working models or an internal map of close relationships. If we move on to the next slide, slide 11, we can see here a description of two primary attachment styles. So the young child who develops working models of relationships where adults are seen as available and dependable and reliable, the adult comes to them if they're distressed and provides soothing, and the child develops an expectation that will happen. They also view themselves as resourceful and resilient, that this child is actually able to self-soothe even in the absence of that caretaker figure. The other style is a more insecurely attached child, and these children often experience anxious, ambivalent attachments. They may have had experience of unreliable parental care, loss, neglect, or abuse in some form. And this is where the views of others, and the others of relationships, is that these relationships are precarious or dangerous or unreliable, that if they're distressed, their needs won't be met. There isn't a level of attunement between the caregiver and the child. And this child will often develop patterns of attachment where there'll be incredible dependency on their caregiver, and any separation will feel like an annihilation, to a position where they'll be compulsively self-reliant. They'll effectively say, I don't need other people, I don't need relationships, you're disappointed or abandoned. What we know here is that in adulthood, the insecurely attached adult is overrepresented in the population that has difficulty with bereavement. That this is a population that has struggles with separation, whether that's a temporary separation or a separation through death. So this internal working model is really quite critical in terms of how we deal with separation. If we're separated from somebody we love, even on a temporary basis, the extent of, for some people, that's an incredibly distressing experience. The next slide, 12, of course, one couldn't give a presentation without mentioning at some stage the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and her publication in 1969 of the book On Death and Dying. This in many ways filled, a vacuum in many ways in the late 60s, early 70s, although people like Colin Murray Parks and John Bowlby had written in very similar terms. But Kubler-Ross, of course, conceptualized the five stages of receiving catastrophic news: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. This was really a model of anticipatory grief, how people deal with receiving, in most cases, a terminal diagnosis. Although she certainly had an enormous influence on the palliative care movement, particularly in North America, this was a model that, as I say here, mutated into the five stages of grief and has been applied to every experience of human loss and change one can imagine. Even the management literature invokes Kubler-Ross's five stages for understanding organizational change. The major difficulty with her model is that, in fact, there's really no data that supports it. There's no suggestion in the research literature that people do follow a sequential period of stages akin to what she described. And I think the other impact of this model is that it was translated into particular sorts of interventions. So if, for example, the client's angry, you encourage them to do certain things to kind of expiate that anger. And that all of those recommendations in later research we find does nothing but really reinforce and strengthen the anger rather than dissipate it. So let's look at perhaps a model that's more helpful, and we'll move on to the next slide, slide 13. And this is the work of William Warden. Bill Warden's an American clinical psychologist whose book, Grief Counseling and Grief Therapy, a Handbook for the Mental Health Practitioner, is now in its fourth edition. And Bill suggests that grief is a highly idiosyncratic experience. It's influenced by a number of mediators. And the next slide, titled Mediators of Mourning, begins to outline these features. So he suggests the first thing is that, in a sense, we need to know the person who died. It's been suggested that those in the best position to provide support to the bereaved are those who actually knew the deceased. So the question is, who was this person? And also, what was the nature of their relationship? What was the nature of the attachment? So we can see here the importance of Bowlby's attachment theory. What was the strength of the relationship, the security that came from it? All relationships, to some extent, are ambivalent. Was this a markedly ambivalent relationship? Was it a highly conflictual relationship? Or was it a relationship where there was incredible, perhaps a high level of dependency? So these relational factors, in the context of discovering who this person was, can be of significance. In a sense, often in bereavement counselling, we bring the deceased into the room, and often through stories and recollection, we get a sense of these attachment relationships. The next slide talks about the importance of how the person actually died. The first two would be proximity, physical proximity. Was a person present at the time of death? Were they supported during that process? Whether that's in an ED or in a palliative context, was there someone there who provided them for a means of understanding that experience? Or were they separated by some geographic distance that may have been difficult? The second would be the issue of suddenness or unexpectedness. And I think it's what's really important here is that we actually appreciate the bereaved person's subjective experience of suddenness or unexpectedness. This that came home to me recently when a man whose wife died in a palliative care unit said, you know, I didn't expect her to get better. I'd been told many times by the nurses and doctors that she wasn't going to get better, but I didn't expect her to die either. So this somewhat kind of incongruity in terms of what's often referred to as middle knowledge, that we know something in our head, but it's still experienced as sudden or unexpected. The third is the issue of violence or trauma. And again, I think it's important to key into the experience of the bereaved person with respect to this. Were there aspects of the death experience that were particularly problematic? Were there multiple losses? Now, these may be non-death related losses, an individual who may have been made redundant, experienced the death of a family member, maybe experiencing their own changes in health. It's important for us to understand and appreciate the range of losses, death and non-death, that the bereaved person is dealing with. The next feature would be the preventability of the death, that the bereaved person feels that they did or failed to do something to make this death happen, or some other party. So, you know, the woman who says, you know, Jack, he had that bad cough 6 months ago, you know, before he died, and I said, you know, go and get a chest x-ray, get that checked out, and he didn't. If only he had. So this is often reflected in the if-onlys or I-should-haves in terms of this question of preventability. And often, of course, information can attend to some of these issues. The second last would be an ambiguous death, perhaps less an issue in a palliative care context, but this is particularly where there may be brain death, or there may be a death where a body is not recovered. Say in Victoria here, when there's a boating fatality, in 30% of cases a body is never recovered, and so this poses particular challenges. And the third would be a stigmatised death. Often these are deaths that evoke anxiety or embarrassment in others, or deaths that one has difficulty talking about. I guess the classic examples here would be suicide and deaths as a result of overdose, but there may be in fact some cancers that may be more difficult or more stigmatised than others. We move on to the next slide, which is 16. It's important to have a historical context or a context around the death. So what was going on prior to the death? This might be focused around last conversations, things said, things not said. We're also interested in how people have dealt with other adversities in their life, that human beings tend to be fairly consistent in terms of the sorts of strategies that they use that might be adaptive or less adaptive. The personality of the bereaved is important, their age and gender. We know that younger children are often excluded from conversations and rituals that help them make sense of the loss, in the same way that people with intellectual disabilities may also be excluded. In terms of gender, we know in terms of a range of risk factors that being female is really at the top of that list, followed by being a partner and mothers in particular. So it's important to look at those features. The second would be their coping style. Are they somebody who focuses on a very much kind of a problem action focused style? Do they have more of an emotional way of engaging with loss or more cognitive one? Their attachment style is important, and also generally in terms of the way they think about the loss and their cognitive style is important. We move on to the next, the personality, their self-esteem, their self-efficacy. Do they feel some level of optimism in terms of their ability to deal with this experience of loss? And the last one in that group is their assumptive world beliefs and values. So again, this question of how they made sense of this. Does this death violate their assumptions about the way the world operates? And how does this experience fit into their value system? second last would be their social mediators. We know that of these, one of the strongest predictors is support satisfaction. It's a bereaved person's sense of being supported and surrounded by people that love and care for them and who are accessible to them is of critical importance. And we know that absence of social support is a significant risk factor. Social role involvement relates to the extent to which they're engaged in other roles. We know, for example, that for a parent, having other surviving children is a protective factor. Being involved in community organisations, faith communities, are also bring with them a level of protection. And finally in this group, the religious resources and ethnic expectations. So the extent to which ritual practices and cultural practices are observed or subscribed to, and the extent to which religious resources can be drawn upon, and the extent to which that support is kind of freely given. There are certainly some types of losses where religious resources might be less available to the bereaved. So the next slide really finishes this group of mediators, and this would be the concurrent stressors, the cumulative stresses as a result of this loss. So here we're talking about financial difficulties, changes in accommodation, changes in jobs, changes in being able to manage day-to-day living, and that these concurrent stressors can pose equally as significant demands on the bereaved as some of what we might consider the more traditionally emotion-focused work. So in a sense, these seven mediators provide a kind of a broad framework in terms of identifying what are the critical factors that tend to impact upon the bereavement experience, that provide both measures of risk but also measures of resilience as well. We move on to the next slide 19. Warden also suggests that this is effortful work, and that the bereaved person does engage in a range of activities and tasks. The first is to accept the reality of the loss, and this is really about getting our head and heart around this experience. We often do this through information. How did it happen? Why did it happen? Why did it happen now and not some other stage? We're confronted by the physical reality of the loss also through rituals such as a funeral, where you're confronted by that undeniable physical fact. The viewing of the deceased, the research suggests that for many people can be stressful, but longer term tend to have better outcomes than those who choose not to. So again, this depends very much on the preparation for that experience, the support during that experience, and the extent to which we help people process that experience. We also do accept this reality of the loss through information. This might be through death certificates, and coroner's reports, or even through conversation, using the word dead rather than some more euphemistic term. The second task is to process the pain of grief, which we all do differently. We do it publicly, we do it privately, we do it in conjunction with others. But we do this both privately and publicly, and there is certainly a growing evidence that for many people, the idea of grief work, this active confrontation with the emotional impact, is not necessarily indicated in all cases. The third is to adjust to a world without the deceased. This is a feature really of relearning the world and relearning the self. So this is really about external adjustments. One woman who recently told me that she found herself sobbing beside her car at a petrol station because she couldn't find that little latch to open up the cover to fill the car with petrol. That was something her husband always did. And that for her was an incredibly distressing confrontation. So there's an external adjustment here in terms of changing relationships with other people in the wake of the loss. The second is an internal adjustment. This is a change in identity. Who am I now in the face of this experience? An identity as a widow or as a widower. And the final is a spiritual adjustment. How do I reconcile this experience with a system of belief? And we see that intrinsic spirituality, in general terms, tends to be a protective factor, but we can see also a number of other outcomes. Some people talk about developing a more elaborate spirituality as a result of loss, and others talk about their scaffold of spiritual meaning being unable to hold this experience and that being rejected or changed. And the next slide shows the fourth task, which is to find an enduring connection with the deceased in the midst of embarking on a new life. And this really reflects this changed view from moving from broken bonds to continuing bonds, that we maintain an ongoing connection with the deceased in many cases. But this is not a connection that prevents us from living fully and into the future. So we can move to the next title slide, Systemic Context of Grieving, and just beyond it to slide 22. This is an attempt to look at the systemic context of grieving. So at the broader level, the broader social system, the society and the culture within which we're embedded has cultural, religious discourses, and also the way we talk about and use language around loss shapes private and public mourning. So the extent to which emotions may be seen as a private affair, the extent to which we may be uncomfortable with strong public expressions of grief. The second is the family system, and the family has rules and hierarchies about the nature of grief, the extent to which we talk about it or don't talk about it, the extent to which we memorialise or don't. So again, that's another enabling and constraining factor. And then the self system, which we've already touched upon. These will be the stories the individual tells themselves about the experience of loss, how they deal with loss, and the resources that they're able to draw upon. If we move to the next slide, disenfranchised grief, this is a term that really was developed in the late 80s that suggests that there are certain sorts of losses that are not or can't be openly acknowledged, publicly mourned, or socially supported. So this again is the idea that there are feeling or grieving rules that prescribes how, when, for how long people should grieve. So for example, in many cultures, the focus is on kin or family relationships. So for example, the grief that we might feel for a close friend may not be recognised or validated. That there are certain sorts of relationships. For example, the death of a companion animal would be one example where for people that death of a family member is felt acutely. Or that there are particular people who are excluded, such as children, people with often older people, or people with cognitive deficits. But also one of the ways that grief is disenfranchised is actually the way we actually go about grieving. And if we move to the next slide, titled Styles of Grieving, we see here that on the left-hand side, there is in many ways a fairly dominant style, which is referred to as the intuitive style, which suggests that grief is a highly emotional experience. It's about the expression of strong affect and feeling, that there's a strong social dimension. We do that in the company of others. We do it with family, friends. We may access a support group or counselling. But this griever tends to seek out support that's available. So the dominant quality to this particular style is about managing the feelings that come up. And in our culture, these would be seen as more feminine attributes. I'm not suggesting here that this is the way that women grieve, that with any men who grieve in this particular style. But this is certainly one very common style. On the other end of this continuum is a more instrumental style, where grief is much more about doing things. It's more active. It's more solitary, it's more cognitive, it's more future-focused, it's more private and invisible. And this is where grief is often seen as a problem-solving activity, something that one addresses in a very kind of direct way. So this is really about managing the thoughts that are prompted by this experience. And these, again, in our culture will be seen as more masculine. But of course, these styles are often blended. People may move from one style to another. In many ways, we disenfranchise, as a counselling community, the instrumental griever shortly after the death. There's a suspicion about a lack of affect or expression. And down the track, sometime after the death, the intuitive griever is often disenfranchised because they're still expressing strong emotions sometime after the death itself. This also has some relevance too, also in terms of the sorts of supports we provide bereaved people. So the intuitive griever will often warmly welcome counselling, participation in bereavement support groups and so forth, but we're unlikely to see the more instrumental griever present in those sorts of ways. The instrumental griever is more likely to engage in reading about the experience of others, online support, engaging in political action or fundraising for cancer research would be another example of a more instrumental style. let's move on to the next slide, skipping over the title dual process model, to slide 26. And this really represents the most contemporary way of understanding the grief experience. The grief isn't about stages or phases or tasks, but it's a process of oscillating between two primary stressors. This is the work of Hank Schutt and his colleagues in the Netherlands, who really have drawn from stress and coping research and suggested that within the context of everyday life, the grieving person is dealing with two issues. On the left-hand side, the issue is oriented towards the loss itself. This is really the primary stressor, the emotional demands, so the intrusion of grief on day-to-day life, this continuing bond being reformed and changed, and about the person not wanting the world to be different. So this is very much confronting the emotional dimensions of the loss. On the other side is a focus on restoration, and this is really the problems and the secondary stressors, dealing with all the changes that this experience has brought to bear, doing new things. We can see in this model that there is a place for distraction, denial and avoidance of grief. And it's also about developing new roles and identities and relationships. So people effectively dose themselves. They oscillate, and this oscillation might take place in seconds, days or weeks, but there is this active movement that continues on as people accommodate to the loss and the emotional demands, as well as the restoration and problem demands. This has really informed a lot of the clinical interventions that we need to address both the emotion and the problem-focused aspects of loss. If we think of the restoration-oriented, these will be things such as, you know, developing new skills, developing new relationships, and so forth. If we move to the next slide, 27, there's only been one study that's actually looked at bereaved people before they're bereaved. This is called the Clock or the Changing Lives of Older Couples study, which looked at 1,500 married couples, one of whom was over 65 years of age, and tracked them for many years. And so this really involves 118 in that sample who experienced bereavement. So if we move to the next slide, 28, we see here that we have measures before death, pre-loss, 6 months after the loss, and then 18 months after the loss. The vertical scale is depression. There wasn't a grief measure per se, but what we see here is grief, if you like, is a common cold. This idea of good functioning, a period of increased distress, and then a resolution. But this idea of common grief only existed in 10% of that sample. So this idea of common grief is really anything but common. If we move to the next slide, we can see the trajectory for over 45% of the sample, and this is a resilient trajectory. There's very little in the way of distress that's evidenced in this subgroup. These were not people who were cold. These were people who were in positive and warm relationships. They were able to access positive memories of the deceased. But again, clearly, the most common response to loss, at least in this group, is that of resiliency. If we move to the next slide, 30, we see the trajectory of chronic grief. People who were managing well before the loss, but following the death, they have increased distress, which remains. This is a group who tend to be, in terms of their attachment style, insecure. They tend to be ruminating a great deal, and they tend to be asking questions and searching for meaning in this loss. The next slide, 31, shows another trajectory. This is people who had high levels of depression before and after the loss. And this is really a trajectory of chronic depression. Most studies where we're seeing people only 6 months after the loss, we would confuse this group with the previous group. So this is suggesting that bereavement and depression are two separate trajectories, and that we need to get good data in terms of people's history of depression when we see them in the bereaved phase. And the final group is a group who had high levels of distress and improved in function following the death. I describe this as the group where death was not the problem, death was the solution. And there are really two primary groups here. One is where people are in unrewarding, unfulfilling or complex relationships. And also in this study, carers were overrepresented in this group. So again, the relief of burden of care. So Moving on to the next slide, 33. What we see here, the people who weren't depressed prior to the loss, we should be helping them foster the process and construction of new meaning around the loss. But for those who are depressed, we need to then focus on treatments that focus on depression, bolstering self-esteem. The depressed group were also a group who were struggling with the day-to-day demands of bereavement. So let's skip over the next title slide, the effectiveness of grief and bereavement interventions, to slide 35. A number of studies have looked at the effectiveness of grief interventions. Most of these have focused either on primary groups, so this would be a group who is simply comprised of asymptomatic bereaved people. The secondary group, this would be bereaved people who would be part of a risk group, such as bereaved mothers, for example. And a third would be the tertiary group, where people actually already meet a diagnostic criteria and are symptomatic. The bottom line here is that the efficacy studies suggest that the only group where there is sustained impact is in the tertiary preventive intervention. Interventions for the primary and secondary groups tend to have limited efficacy, or they're temporary gains that when we look at control and treatment groups further down the track, there is very little evidence. So, again, moving to the next slide, 36, the general pattern emerging from the review of the literature is that the more complicated the grief process, the better the chance of bereavement interventions leading to positive results. So again, the general data would suggest somewhere around 10 to 15% of a general population would meet this criteria. Moving on to the next slide, there is some suggestions that there is a downside of intervention. One study that shows that when people are receiving bereavement counselling, the level of social support diminishes. There's also been a suggestion that providing universal bereavement counselling is wasteful of resources. And some evidence, although not compelling, that that there is a stigmatising impact in terms of the provision of bereavement care. Okay, so moving on to slide 38. Clearly, the research would indicate that it's very difficult to make reliable predictions of longer-term adjustment until 4 to 6 months post-death. The most current diagnostic criteria would suggest 6 months post-death if people are still struggling significantly. And here we're talking about, chronic and intense impacts with very little change, that it's unlikely to resolve itself after 6 months. So there are a number of issues that I've highlighted there in that slide in terms of things we can do in terms of supporting the bereaved person. If we move on to slide 39, the general conclusions is for low-risk bereaved, recommend things such as good sleep hygiene, exercise, daily routines. For those with major depression or anxiety, the usual treatments for those conditions. And for prolonged grief disorder, there are a number of promising interventions. There's some studies at the moment that are looking at pharmacotherapy. There is certainly a very successful complicated grief therapy that's been developed by Catherine Shear at the University of Columbia. Also some evidence around pre-loss preparation, psychoeducation, and also meaning-based therapies, which are probably most commonly popularized by the work of Robert Niemeyer. So the next slide, slide 40, suggests that the worst-case scenario would be unsolicited routine referral shortly after bereavement for no other reason than that the person has suffered a bereavement. That certainly would be the worst outcome. So in summary, on 41, intervention needs to be focused on risk groups and also individuals suffering from complicated grief. There are a number of ways of assessing complicated grief, and we'll move on to that now. So slide 43, just conscious that time is starting to move against us. Freud suggests that although mourning involves grave departures from a normal attitude towards life, it never occurs to us to regard it as a pathological condition and to refer it to medical treatment. Freud's partly right here. For most people, the treatment is neither indicated nor particularly beneficial. But we know, if we move to slide 44, that complicated grief is different from typical grief. There's often lifelong intermittent levels of distress. What we're talking about here are severe symptoms that persist without any kind of progress. And people feel very much that they're stuck. It's both chronic and unremitting. It impacts adversely on their capacity to work and to function. Slide 45 indicates that there are really two triggers: a sudden violent death that assaults the person's assumptive world, and secondly, any significant loss for a person who has vulnerable attachment styles. So slide 46 shows the proposed criteria for prolonged grief disorder. This is a proposal both for the DSM and the ICD, which suggests that this is a chronic and disruptive yearning, pining. People have four of those eight features under criterion B. They have marked disturbance, and they exist for at least six months. We move to slide 47. We don't have time now to go into this in any great detail, but there are basically four evidence-based interventions for this group. The first would be focused family grief therapy. This is the work of David Kassane and Sid Block, initially from the University of Melbourne. The second would be complicated grief treatment. This is the work of Catherine Shear, as I mentioned earlier, at Columbia. Catherine Shear sees grief is a trauma. The trauma is generally avoided, and she draws very strongly on the dual process model as a treatment intervention. That's a manualized treatment program over about 12 sessions. Cognitive behavioral therapy, this particular work of Paul Bolden and others. And finally, the mini reconstruction approach. The largest proponent would have been would be Robert Niemeyer, a clinical psychologist in the US. And probably it's those two that I've circled in blue that in fact are very compatible. I think there are some real issues around family-focused grief therapy in terms of resources and implementation. But the complicated grief therapy and the constructivist approaches would be probably the strongest in terms of an evidence base. Moving to slide 48, this is just a very brief summary here of the complicated grief therapy of Catherine Shear. Said it's a manualized therapy. There's a significant component of psychoeducation. I think a lot of good grief therapy is good grief education about normal and complicated grief. It does draw upon this dual process of adjustment. She draws certainly from the trauma field about exposure-based therapy, the sorts of things, practices, behaviors that people are avoiding. And there's certainly a lot of work around exposure, conversations with the deceased, and detailed retelling of the death scene. The next slide, 49, really describes the core of the meaning reconstruction approach. The grieving entails reconstructing a world of meaning that's been challenged by the loss. So here, this is very much about a range of kind of narrative approaches. If you Google the work of Robert Niemeyer, there's certainly a lot of material out there. Slide 50 is a quote from the American philosopher Tom Addy, which says, although bereavement may be a choiceless event, the grieving experience understood as an active coping process is permeated by choice. There are many things that we can do for and with bereaved people. It's certainly not an experience that is not rich in choice in terms of the way we can work with bereaved people. And the slide 51 is a quote from the American psychiatrist George Hagman that says that many problems arise from bereavement are due to the failure of other survivors to engage with the bereaved person in mourning together. That many of the problems that bereaved people have are social problems, the inability or unwillingness of a community of care to join them in mourning together. So in terms of kind of a very brief summary, I guess there are two primary ways of helping. The first is really about strengthening the healing community, so focusing on the family as a unit of support, linking people with others who've had similar experiences of loss through self-help and grief support groups, the use of community rituals, psychoeducation, running information sessions for bereaved clients, normalising the experience, strengthening connections. The second is perhaps a more direct engagement with bereaved people, where we allow ourselves to share that continuing connection with the deceased. We open ourselves to experience part of the pain of that loss. That we're very careful about imposing our own worldview or our own constructions of meaning on this experience. You know, I love the old Yiddish expression that God gave us two ears and one mouth, and we should use them in those proportions. It's really about the quality of our attentiveness to the story, the extent to which we can hold the experience of the bereaved person as they make sense of this experience. Having an understanding of the challenges, particularly with certain types of losses, being aware of that, and also being on the lookout to integrate the person back into their community of care, into their family, rather than becoming a substitute for their system of care. So that is a very, very brief overview.